Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. In October 2002, on the one-year anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, then-Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld told CNN, "The Taliban are gone, Al-Qaeda is gone." And yet, 16 years later, there are still U.S. troops in both Afghanistan and Iraq. And many of those who have returned over those years have survived wounds and injuries that would have killed them in previous wars, thanks to advances in surgery and medicine. But now, more than ever, our returning veterans need more than just a thank you for your service gesture. They need health care, access to mental care, and mental health treatment, job training, and the money promised them through the GI Bill. Joining us now is Paul Rykoff, the founder and CEO of the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans Association, IAVA. He served as an Army First Lieutenant and Infantry Rifle Platoon Leader in Iraq, and he is the author of Chasing Ghosts, Failures and Facades in Iraq, A Soldier's Perspective. Paul, welcome to our show.
Great to talk to you again, Leonard. Thank you for having me.
How many U.S. military veterans are alive today? Do we know?
Total in America, we're just over 20 million, and that's all generations. And the new generation that we represent, the post-9/11 generation, is about 3 million. It's a much more diverse population of that 3 million is than the prior generations. It's about 20% women, much more ethnically diverse. Even geographic distributions are pretty different. But it's right now still a sizable part of the population. But one thing that we always want to underscore is it's actually shrinking pretty rapidly. So the World War II vets will quickly all be gone. And then Vietnam vets kind of right behind them. And we'll look at going from a high point of almost 12% of the population back in World War II to being less than one half of 1%. So I think it just underscores, you know, the importance of conversations like these and the importance of allies, folks who can help veterans amplify their voices and their issues.
Do they all face certain issues, or are there issues that are unique to Iraq and Afghanistan vets?
You know, I think there are similarities. You know, every generation of veterans goes overseas and serves, and not everybody comes home damaged or broken, but nobody comes home unchanged. So I think there are commonalities across generations, especially mental health as an example. You know, in the old days, they called it shell shock. Now we know it's post-traumatic stress disorder. I think we've actually made some headway in understanding and treating some of these mental health issues, but it spans all generations. I think we all interact with the VA, you know, in some areas that can be a very positive experience, and others it's a very negative one. For our generation, there are some unique, we think, opportunities and challenges. We've prioritized them for 2018 in what we call our Big Six priorities, and if folks are listening and want to follow along, it's IAVA.org/Big Six. And for our generation, you know, we see suicide as right now the number one issue. We're also focused on women veterans, recognizing and supporting women veterans. That is much more of a priority for our younger crew of folks. We want to reform the VA. We need to protect our GI Bill, which is the post-9/11 GI Bill, the one that's really only available to our generation. And then two other new and emerging issues that are unique to our community. The first is burn pits, which are kind of like our generation's Agent Orange.
Yeah.
Toxin exposures that millions have been exposed to, almost similar to what we saw, you know, here in New York City after 9/11. You know, folks were exposed to lots of burning materials, waste, and they're having, you know, long-term adverse health effects. And then the sixth one, Leonard, is...
Wait. Since you brought up burn pits, what types of materials is the military burning in these pits?
And everything. So it's really everything. It could be medical waste. It could be plastics. It can be disposed military vehicles. I mean, when I went to Iraq in 2003, 2004, What we basically do is dig gigantic holes in the ground, throw everything that we need to dispose of, and set it on fire. There were no incinerators, you know, there were no landfills. And there's sometimes also an issue of concern about, you know, the enemy being able to capture materials that might prove valuable. But, you know, there's always this, maybe Vietnam generation, there was this image popularized in films where you had kind of a soldier stirring an oil can full of, you know, feces and waste and burning. You know, that's what this is, magnified. And we think, you know, millions of folks have been affected.
What are the symptoms?
Members say more than two-thirds of them feel they were exposed and might have adverse health effects.
And what kind of adverse health effects have they had? And can't this practice just be stopped?
Mostly it's respiratory issues that we've seen so far. And just like Agent Orange, this is still early stage, so it's hard for us to understand the true human scope of these issues. You know, we've seen some incidents, high rates of cancer. We're not sure to what extent those are directly attributed to burn pits, but our members feel that there's good reason to be concerned. And what we're most of all calling for is research. We shouldn't have to go 40 years to properly recognize the health impacts of burn pits in the same way we had to with Agent Orange. I mean, just this week in Washington, the Department of Veterans Affairs came out against expanded support for what's called Blue Water Navy veteran support. These are Vietnam veterans that were on blue water ships kind of farther out from the sea that were exposed to Agent Orange and they believe had adverse health effects. But 40 years later, our Vietnam vets this week are in Washington still fighting for that proper support and recognition. And we fear that we're going to face the same sort of problems, not just now, but for generations. It could be all the way through to birth defects. We've seen Vietnam veterans with high rates of birth defects among their children. So this is a long tail issue with potentially huge financial and health costs that we really need attention and focus on.
Isn't there a Burn Pits Accountability Act?
There is. Yeah, that's what we're pushing for right now.
Is it in Congress?
They've actually tried to clamp down on the... Sorry?
Is it in Congress?
It is. It is. And if folks, again, are following along, we try to make it easy. We're activists, and we know there are a lot of folks, you know, getting information thrown at them. But if you go to iaba.org/burnpits, you can see the data from our members. You can learn more about the issues, and you can find out how to get involved. We're calling on all members of Congress to pass the Burn Pits Accountability Act this year. It doesn't look good for getting anything done before the end of the year, but it has gotten bipartisan support. And some of the tri-state area representatives have been especially helpful. Senator Gillibrand, who's been a great partner for us on 9/11-related health impacts, and the Zadroga bill has stepped up to help us again here. But we're going to need community support. We're going to need grassroots support because this potentially could be devastating for an entire generation of people.
But don't all politicians claim to be in support of the military? Is this simply a matter of money, of coming up? Is this a budgetary issue, or are they lying to us?
You know, Leonard, you and I have talked, I think, on and off over the last 14 years or so, and you know, I think a lot about these issues, and I think on a very basic level, it's almost a moral imperative. I think that this country, you know, almost every generation has failed to understand the true cost of war. You know, we send folks to war, and we allocate money for bullets, bombs, and missile systems, but we don't allocate at the same time the health impact support that will be necessary down the line. So, you know, it was only maybe 7-8 years after the Afghanistan war began that we really came close to an adequate VA budget, yet the Pentagon budget was skyrocketing. So there's a disconnect. And I think it's exacerbated in our generation because so few people serve. You know, it's not like World War II where everybody knew somebody who was in. The politicians talk a good game. I mean, we are the ultimate applause line. I've said a lot that veterans are kind of like babies and puppies. Babies, puppies, and vets are kind of the applause lines that everybody gets. You don't want to cross those groups because they're popular. It's like the ultimate populist issue. And I think, frankly, Trump has understood that and at times manipulated it because he understands how popular it is. But when it comes down to it, we're just not meeting the demand.
Well,
and I think too many in Congress aren't feeling the pressure.
And the increased military budget usually means developing new weapon systems or paying for more weapons rather than allotting money to the veterans. But let's back up a bit. Why did you join the military? Did you come from a military family?
You know, I came from a military family in the old sense, meaning my family was living in the Bronx, and my grandfather was drafted for World War II. He had immigrated to this country when he was a teenager, you know, illegally, and came to serve 3 years in the South Pacific. And then my father lived in the same neighborhood in the Bronx on Troutman Avenue, and he was drafted in 1967 for Vietnam. So when my time came, you know, I was lucky enough to go to school. I played football and was able to go to college. But I really felt like I had an obligation to give back to my country. I wanted to also test myself as a leader and find out what I was made of. You know, some of it was a bit of the romanticized time of living in America as a young man. But I think at the end of the day, I really wanted to give something back to a country that I love. But my family, you know, we find now that my family is not unique. A lot of us who join the military nowadays are kind of legacies, especially in the Deep South and other parts. It often becomes a cultural part of families. And for some, it's, of course, the economic opportunity, the GI Bill and other incentives I think are attractive. And that was attractive to me, too. But there's also, I think, a sense of service. I don't think it's unique to the military. You know, I thought about either the military or the Peace Corps, frankly. I wasn't sure which direction I was going to go. And I think either direction would have been, you know, a different way for me to serve that I hope would have been impactful.
Was 9/11 a determining factor?
Not directly for me, because I enlisted in 1998. Mm-hmm. So I had joined before 9/11, and I was actually serving in the New York National Guard on 9/11. So the day of 9/11, you know, I went down to Ground Zero, like so many others, to volunteer. And then my National Guard unit was activated that night. So officially, you know, that was my first ever real deployment, if you will. I never imagined when I, you know, was training at Camp Smith or, you know, drilling here in New York City, you know, as a National Guardsman, we never think you're going to be deployed within your own city. But, you know, that's the way history unfolded, and that ended up being my first deployment. I then volunteered to go to Afghanistan, was not called for Afghanistan, but volunteered for Iraq and then ended up being a part of the initial invasion in 2003 and 2004.
Did you agree at the time with the Bush administration's stated reason for the invasion, that Saddam Hussein had played a role in the 9/11 attacks and had weapons of mass destruction?
No, I mean, and with all due respect, you know, that's one interpretation of their rationale, right? I mean, there's probably 10 along the way. I think what I was overwhelmingly concerned about was that there wasn't a clear and present danger presented to the American people by Saddam Hussein. I wrote about this pretty extensively in my book, and I said the opening line of my book is, you know, George Bush had better be effing right, because when he made this plan to invade on the basis of weapons of mass destruction, at least that was, I think, the final case made. I never would have imagined that they wouldn't find them. You know, even if they weren't there, we all figured, hey, the CIA is going to put them somewhere. There's no way we'd have that kind of egg on our face as a nation. But like many people, I had my reservations. I had serious concerns about whether it was potentially the worst foreign policy mistake in our country's modern history. But I also had a duty to serve. And I felt like, you know, if this did unfold, I could make a difference on the ground. You know, a lot of folks ask us as vets, Leonard, you know, how many people we've killed. They've never asked us how many people we've saved. And I really did feel like I could make a difference on the ground with my unit and trying to do some good. And it definitely wasn't a perfect deployment, and we made some mistakes along the way. But by and large, I like to think that my unit was a positive force during a really, really tough time.
Where were you? What was your range of activities, and where were you stationed during your time there?
So I was in a light infantry unit, so we were grunts. We would, you know, walk around and patrol and do security operations, and that spanned everything from checkpoints that I think have become, you know, a really kind of iconic way of understanding the difficulty that our troops face in Iraq and Afghanistan, these, you know, incredibly tense situations where you don't know what kind of car is coming at you, if it's an enemy car, if it's a friendly car, and you've got, you know, essentially 19, 20-year-olds in a foreign land where they don't speak English, where the other side doesn't speak English, and most of us didn't speak Arabic. So it was checkpoints, it was patrols, it was clearing of buildings. It was, you know, like every soldier, a lot of it's sitting around and waiting, which I think is the unglorious side of this that folks don't appreciate. But we were really, you know, we were in a tough spot. We were ground troops in an urban environment. and we really caught the brunt of some of the worst of the insurgency as it started to develop. But it gave us, you know, I think a ground's eye view for where the policy failures were, you know, how the Iraqi people were experiencing this. And it's part of what motivated me to start this kind of work when I came home, when I really felt like our voice wasn't heard and the guys and gals that I had served with really weren't being represented in the media or in the national conversation. So we built IAVA to be really a platform where the average soldiers can have a voice in our national policy and most importantly and urgently at times taking care of our own.
And that's why you decided to write Chasing Ghosts, which was published in 2006.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it was at that time, it was really just my journal. I had been journaling while I was in Iraq and sending letters home to my girlfriend and kind of cobbled those together into a memoir about, you know, my experience during that time period, which in retrospect now, you know, I think was really important. Not because my personal experience was so unique, but because we saw so many phases of the early part of the war, you know, from the buildup to the invasion to kind of the lull to the birth of the insurgency to the full-flown insurgency, and then even to the point where I came home. And, you know, it was 2004, and John Kerry and George Bush were sort of having a debate about Iraq, but there wasn't really a robust conversation, and that's where I started and IAVA started on some of the very basic issues, like trying to explain to folks that there actually was an insurgency, that things were not okay, that we didn't have basic equipment and support that we needed. That's really the genesis of what I think became for us kind of the modern veterans movement, which builds on the backs of, you know, the Vietnam vets and every other generation that came before us.
I'm speaking with Paul Rykoff, the founder and executive director of the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. This is Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Before you established the IAVA, what did you imagine you'd do after you returned?
I wasn't sure. I was like many other veterans, I was transitioning home and trying to figure it out. I thought maybe I might go back into the military, thought about going to graduate school. Was just trying to reestablish myself and really wasn't sure. I had a college degree, but on a very basic level, you know, I was pissed off. You know, I was conflicted and I had just come back from this really difficult experience. We had some guys in our unit that were wounded, that were killed. And I really had a voice that I felt was not that unique. I felt like we all had a voice that was not being heard. One of the first interviews I ever did was with Sean Hannity on Fox News, which was almost more surreal than going to Iraq. But, you know, he told me that he didn't think what I was saying was true, that we actually had adequate body armor and that I must have been misled or, you know, things were fine in Iraq. And at that point, I was really one of the only Iraq veterans in the national media. None had been elected to Congress at that point. So, quickly, you know, I got a lot of support from other men and women who felt like their voices were unheard too. And that was the genesis of it. But if you would have told me, you know, 14 years ago that I would continue to be an activist and running a nonprofit, it's really, you know, not the path I would have expected for sure. But it's also been satisfying. And whenever I get a chance to talk in the media, I want to encourage, you know, young people to get involved in politics and in advocacy and in activism, because there's so much important work to be done. And I didn't know that was a pathway for me coming home from Iraq, you know, 14 years ago.
What was worse, being in Iraq or having to talk to Sean Hannity?
You know, Sean Hannity actually makes less sense than Iraq. So it was, I probably go with that in some levels. It was definitely more daunting being on national TV in a suit. It was not a comfortable environment for me, you know, years ago. And I bet you it's probably similar now. I'd probably still rather go back to Iraq than have to have a conversation with Sean Hannity.
How big is IAVA and what type of work are you engaged in?
Well, we've got about 400,000 members now around the country and around the world. We're really the next generation of what's traditionally been called a veteran service organization. So if you think of the VFW or the American Legion, really, our most direct predecessor was the Vietnam Veterans of America. And we primarily focus on advocacy, being a voice for veterans in the national media and in Washington and trying to promote and create change. Public awareness is always a huge part of what we do. on everything from the recent GI Bill failures to the fact that we're simply still at war. And then we do direct services nationwide. We've got a case management program that serves thousands of veterans every year. So we've got master's level social workers that are here 24 hours a day for any veterans who are in need. We basically realized that nobody was taking care of our own, and we needed to figure out a way to do it. So we created a program here in New York City called the Rapid Response Referral Program that was started with a grant in New York City, then expanded to New York State, and is now a nationwide program that serves thousands. But if anybody's listening and they've got a vet in their family, or they are a veteran themselves, and they need help with housing or mental health or navigating your GI Bill, or even just connecting with other veterans in your area, you can go to our website, and that's really a critical part of our work every day. We are a nonprofit, relatively small, and headquartered here in New York, which I think is also important. A lot of other organizations are headquartered in Washington or other places, but especially after 9/11, when folks were saying, you know, you couldn't build something like this here, we felt like this was the right place to be. For all the other reasons, New York is amazing as well, but in some respect, it was also symbolic for us to say this was a new generation, and that our headquarters was going to be in a new place that was really about the future.
You mentioned earlier the alarmingly high rate of suicide among Afghan and Iraqi veterans. And it's been linked to PTSD?
Yeah, I mean, it's suicide is such a tough and complicated issue that I think we see all Americans wrestling with right now. But for veterans, it's especially tough. We lose 20 men and women every single day to suicide.
Wow.
That's of all generations. Many of them are older vets, but every day, 20 men and women are lost to suicide. And that's really, in our view, you know, a public health epidemic. We're losing our brothers and sisters almost daily to a silent killer. Post-traumatic stress disorder is an issue, but it can be depression. It can be a sense of disconnect. We've got, you know, high rates of opioid abuse. There's no one reason, in my experience, having done this for, you know, a decade and a half, that someone gets to that point. And most of all, you know, there's no silver bullet to respond, and we're pushing for more treatment and mental health support. But most of all, what I've found is men and women need hope, and they need connection. And that often can come from other veterans in a powerful and important way. So that's a huge part of what we do, is just give them an extended family they can be a part of. But this is an alarming issue that we really feel is not getting enough attention. Rachel Maddow, who probably most of your listeners know, once compared it to me to the early days of the AIDS movement, where they felt like there were so many folks that were dying, that were young, that were being lost, and there was really no public health response. There was no acknowledgement from the powers in Washington. And it's a very different issue, but it is, you know, unprecedented to lose this many people at this rate that have so much potential. So we're sounding the alarm on it, and we're also trying to provide solutions in the meantime. But we think it's one of the most important public health and national security issues facing our country right now.
You mentioned that PTSD used to be called shell shock, but there is a difference. Shell shock usually applied to only people who'd been in combat, but we're seeing PTSD from people who haven't necessarily been in a firefight, but they still have been overwhelmed by the stress or the fear of their Jeep being hit by an IED or all sorts of other things.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and PTSD is not unique to veterans alone. I mean, anyone who's experienced a trauma, can find themselves facing post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yesterday, we had a guest on our show who suffered from child abuse, and that he was constantly misdiagnosed, and eventually they figured out that his problem was PTSD.
Yeah, I mean, you're hitting it on the head there, Leonard. I mean, you know, we have a high rate of military sexual trauma and sexual assault in the military as well. You know, that can be a source of post-traumatic stress disorder. Even, I think what I try to underscore for people, because you haven't deployed doesn't mean your life isn't incredibly stressful. Just as an example, you could be a drone operator, you know, operating in a base here stateside and still experience, you know, traumatic events that impact your mental health. Just the specter of being deployed for now. Imagine someone who joined when they were 17 or 18 years old, you know, coming from our area, and they've been in the military for the last 15 years. Just the looming threat of being yanked out of your family and sent to a war that maybe you don't support, that can create tremendous mental health stress for our entire community. So It's really a silent killer, but we also think that the advances that are coming from military medicine and veterans treatment can be helpful to people who have experienced child abuse or anything else. There's an old saying that medicine is the only victor in war. If there is a silver lining, we have seen some pretty significant medical advances that we hope can translate to the general population, but we got to put the pedal down, and we've really got to get the president especially to drive a national conversation around this issue.
Is it medical marijuana being used increasingly to treat PTSD? Have there been any findings to prove it is effective, or is the evidence strictly anecdotal?
So that was the sixth issue that I don't think we got to in our big six, but medical marijuana is an issue that our members overwhelmingly support, over 85%. And our members are pretty diverse. The highest percentage are actually Republicans and then Democrats, and a high and increasing number of independents and unaffiliated. So we really span the political spectrum. But for years, our members have said that medical cannabis is something that they support. For pain relief, I think it's pretty substantial at this point that there can be pain relief, especially for folks who are experiencing amputations or other kinds of polytrauma. The verdict is out on PTSD. There has been limited promising research, but that's part of what we're calling for. And we have a bill this year, to go to the VA that would mandate the VA research the impact of cannabis on post-traumatic stress disorder. We need that data to drive the conversation, but we do hear anecdotally from so many of our members that it provides them with relief and it provides them with help. And I think the way we look at it, it's kind of a common sense argument. I mean, you trust us with complex weapon systems and your foreign policy and millions of dollars worth of equipment, but when we come home, we can't be trusted with medical cannabis. I think it's the ultimate absurdity, and it's where the policy is failing. And it's also where, state and federal law are in conflict at times and can create a really difficult situation for a vet on the ground and the vet's doctor. If you're in a state where it's legal and you want to go to a federal facility, which is what a VA is, you're going to be potentially in some conflict. And that's where the regulation is not keeping up with the reality on the ground and the needs of our vets.
You mentioned opioid abuse. That's a form of self-medication.
Yeah, well, it's also, prescribed medication pretty often if you're in the VA. I mean, again, the VA can't prescribe you cannabis. Until recently, service dogs, another innovation that we found to be incredibly helpful. Dogs that can help people with all kinds of mental health injuries have been, was anecdotally supported by our community, and now we've seen more widespread support. But, the easy way is to give a guy or gal a bunch of pills. If they're dealing with severe pain. And again, we've got people who've survived Iraq and Afghanistan that never would have survived in generations prior. Head injuries, polytrauma head injuries, and multiple amputations. These are people that would have died even just 10 years ago. So they're often experiencing some pretty significant pain, and they're often prescribed opioids. And if they experience isolation and they're not wrapped into a community, it can be a dangerous combination. But we don't know also, there may be, an opportunity with medical cannabis to help people who are struggling with that as well. We don't have enough solid data. I won't tell you that we do. But we think there's potential there, and it's potential worth exploring and accelerating.
Well, how did therapy dogs work as a treatment for people who've had PTSD?
It's incredible. I have so many folks, one in our office who's got a therapy dog, and it's, they're well-trained. They're extremely well-trained. They know how to provide them comfort and support. And just to give you a really great example, I had a friend in New York who's a vet who had a service dog and wasn't from New York City. And he got on the subway and was feeling the stress. He was not feeling comfortable. And the dog is actually trained to put his body between the vet and the public. Maneuvers that can actually make that person feel better. They can go into a room and turn on a light. What they can do is really extraordinary. And for, people who are concerned about, the taxpayers' dollars, they're a heck of a lot more financially effective than a bag of pills or a lot of the other alternatives. So we think it's another example of kind of a no-brainer that should have federal support. And we have an extensive policy agenda on our website that gets into these issues and many others that we see as a source of hope and maybe a bit of a silver lining in how we can learn from these traumatic experiences and help everybody.
A recent guest in our show was Eileen Rivers, who's written a book about how sexism is still a problem in the military. Women who wind up in combat situations who don't get the same kind of credit that men do. Is this something that your organization is also dealing with?
Absolutely. It's in that priority list on our Big Six. Last year, we launched a really historic campaign that we've called She Who Born the Battle, which was a campaign to recognize and support women veterans. Now, it's taking on, you know, an issue in particular that we've focused on, which is the VA motto. The VA motto stands on the wall of every single VA facility in the country, hundreds of them. And every time a woman veteran walks through the door, they see a motto from Abraham Lincoln that was put on the walls in 1959 that says, we are here for his widow and for his orphan, for he who born the battle. And we say, what about she who born the battle? That's not a part of what we believe is really a sexist motto, a motto you could never have on a Fortune 500 company. Yet it's the motto on every VA in America. So we launched a campaign to change that motto, to make it more inclusive, to make it for men and women, but also recognizing that women have unique health needs, that they are not being properly supported by the VA on everything from gender-specific care to even the number of hirings that they've done. It's very difficult at times to find a therapist who is a combat veteran herself who can relate to your experience. So it's a big priority for us. The capstone is really changing the motto because we feel like that is a symbolic move that will change the culture at the VA especially. DOD, Department of Defense, also has a huge problem with military sexual trauma and sexual assault. We've been trying to tackle that as well. But we need everyone's support. And again, more info is on our website. I will note that on these issues in particular, it may not surprise folks, but Trump's been silent. He has not commented on the motto change idea. He's actually moved to block it. When there was a scandal within the Department of Defense last year called the Marines United scandal, where nude pictures were posted, hearings were held, and it was really, I think, a revealing part of the underbelly of the sexism in the Marine Corps in particular. The president never even spoke about it, never addressed it. And we need leadership, and we need him to be pressured to respond to those kinds of issues. And if he can't, we need the Secretary of Defense, we need every member of Congress to stand up and make sure that we understand that women are in combat every single day. They're being wounded and killed just like men. And this is a fully, you know, integrated force now. Women are graduating from Ranger School. There was a report recently that one may have recently been awarded the Green Beret, which would be a real significant historic move. And it's a huge priority for us.
I'm speaking with Paul Rykoff, founder and CEO of the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans Association and author of Chasing Ghosts, Failures and Facades in Iraq, A Soldier's Perspective. The discussion about the current situation of veterans in America with Paul Rykoff. And we invite you, if you are a veteran who has something to add to this conversation, to give us a call at 212-209-2877. That's 212-209-2877. Paul, it seems as though every president enters his office, so far his office, promising to fix the Department of Veterans Affairs, but not much seems to change. What aspects of the VA do you see as being in real need of an overhaul?
I'm glad you asked. Before I respond, I just want to echo something. BAI has been really great on our issues as well, Leonard. And I just want to underscore that, you know, our issues are a great example of the power and importance of public radio. There were plenty of times over the last, you know, 10, 15 years where we were trying to get issues, local and national issues covered, and public radio and BAI in particular have been really consistent. And I think that may be a part of the value and importance of the station that people may not appreciate. And it works a lot better than the VA. I think that's at a very basic level. You know, I wrote a tweet yesterday. It said, all we want for Christmas is a VA that works. Maybe underscoring how far the VA still has to go. In the last month, right around Veterans Day, it was pretty widely reported that thousands of veterans did not get their GI Bill housing payments on time. Many in New York and in the tri-state area. What that means is they've signed up for the GI Bill, which is an earned benefit. They've served their country overseas, come home, and they're going to CUNY or Columbia or wherever they're going to school. And the VA pays some of their bills. They pay their tuition. They get a housing allowance that they can use to pay for an apartment or, you know, basic housing on campus. And the GI Bill got screwed up. There was a 50-year-old computer that couldn't calculate a change, and thousands of veterans did not get their housing payments. They had landlords breathing down their throat. They had tremendous emotional and financial stress. We warned the VA and the president, talked about it in the national media back in September.
You had a press conference in Washington, didn't you?
Yep. We did a press conference. We testified. And we were kind of screaming from the mountaintop saying, hey, this looks like it's going to get screwed up. And sure enough, right around Veterans Day, we start hearing from thousands of vets who are just not getting what they are owed. And the impact of that, especially around the holidays, has been devastating. People's credit has been ruined. Now, initially, the VA said they wouldn't even pay folks back. Now they've reversed themselves. Secretary Wilkie is the new VA secretary. He is really the fourth VA secretary we've had since Obama left office, which is another issue we could get into. But on a very basic level, the VA has to work. It has to keep its promise. And the VA is kind of America's handshake with our veterans. We say, okay, you guys are going to serve overseas. When you come home, the VA will be there for you on a very basic level, like making sure you can go to school. So that's, I think, still how far we have to go. Every president says they're going to fix the VA.
Now, what is the VA saying as the reason that the checks aren't being cut in a timely manner?
They said the computers are screwed up. They said they have a 50-year-old computer system, and there was an error, and they gave a whole song and dance about how, you know, they're going to fix it and they're sorry. But, you know, a promise from the VA secretary is not a check you can take to the bank. A press release from a senator is not something you can take to a landlord. I think this is this is very typical. We've seen this before. Actually, in 2009, when the post 9/11 GI Bill was first passed and created, we saw late GI Bill checks. So basic execution and administration of benefits is one of the core functions of the VA that they still haven't been able to get right. And for Trump, he ran on this. He said, I love our veterans. I care about our veterans. He understood the populist power of that. And now he's kind of like the dog that caught the car. He thought this was going to be easy. His people thought this was going to be easy. And they're finding out that the VA is kind of where big ideas go to die. Every president says they're going to change the VA in the same way they say, I'm going to clean up Washington. It's kind of like a throwaway line that people really respond to. But actually getting it done has been hard. And I think that's an area where Trump is failing miserably right now, and veterans are paying the price.
Let's take a call. Hi, BAI, you're on the air.
Oh, yes, thank you. Thank you for taking my call. And I'd like to have the gentleman repeat where he's from and his name, because I'm not a veteran, but I'm trying to help one. And just when I was thinking about housing, the gentleman started talking about it, and that is definitely an issue. And the person I'm trying to help says, oh, they want you to wait until you are evicted or you're in a shelter before they can do something about it. That this doesn't ring right, you know. So, but it sounds in keeping with what he's talking about. I tell you, I talk to people in the public. They all believe this story that, you know, that the government is taking care of the vets. So thank you for, you know, writing that misconception. But the more I talk to this person, he's definitely filling in the blanks and saying he is not, you know, getting the kind of service he, you know, thinks he should get.
So, Paul, what should she do? Paul Rieckhoff, by the way, you should spell your name as well.
Sure. It's Paul Rieckhoff, R-I-E-C-K-H-O-F-F. Easiest way is you can find us online at IAVA.org, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. We're also on Twitter. We're on Facebook. We're on pretty much every form of technology, and we're actually headquartered here in New York City. We've got very, very limited resources, but we don't turn anybody away. And you can send, you know, vets to us. Our services are free, and we also serve all generations. So we know that we're focused specifically on, you know, post 9/11 veterans, but we know that there are other folks who need help as well. And some of the older vets have really been impressed by how quickly we can move, and some of that is due to technology, but we also don't turn away folks who have other than honorable discharges, meaning no matter how you were discharged from the military, whether it was, you know, a discipline issue, or some folks who were even discharged under Don't Ask, Don't Tell and other policies, everybody is welcome at our organization, and we'll do our best to provide support. And if you're listening and you don't need help, we need donations too. We are a nonprofit. We get no federal funding. And we try to make those donations go as far as possible. And right now, what we're actually doing at times is providing emergency financial support for folks who are being foreclosed, who are having those kinds of issues, especially around the holidays. It gets tough, and we try to be there as best we can if the VA can't be.
Caller, is the person you're calling about a vet of Afghanistan or Iraq? Oh, she's gone. Okay, well, thank you so much for your call. Paul, what is the Forever GI Bill?
The Forever GI Bill was an update. The GI Bill is kind of like in many ways, we think it's America's greatest investment. You know, if you want to see the power of what the government can do, it's the GI Bill. At its best, sent a generation to college. We think about the World War II greatest generation, who became a generation of leaders. Many people, we just celebrated the life of President Bush. He was at Yale and used the GI Bill. That entire generation was really built on the GI Bill. So when we came home in 2004 and 2005, it hadn't been updated really since Vietnam. So we passed the first post 9/11 GI Bill in 2008 with Senator Webb and Senator Warner, both from Virginia, both veterans, Republican and Democrat. And every year since, we've basically been updating. So the Forever GI Bill was passed last year to expand the benefit and ensure that it's there forever, for as long as we need. I mean, I think the real issue here is that there was always assumed there would be an end date, that these wars would end. And we've got now forever wars. So we need a Forever GI Bill that ensures that those benefits are there. But on the flip side, what also happened in the last year is the Department of Defense tried to limit the benefit. They came back and said, you know what, we're going to limit what's called your transferability to only 15 years, meaning once you hit the 15-year mark, you can't give it to your kids anymore, which was just an example of how they're trying to chip away at it. If you look at other benefits programs, if you think about Medicare or Medicaid, you know, they were passed, and then for many years, there's a kind of policy position to protect those benefits. That's where we are with the GI Bill. We passed it. We've created it. Now we're probably going to have to spend the rest of our lives protecting it from cuts and from budget hawks who want to go in there and think they can save a couple dollars by cutting the GI Bill. But most importantly, it was over an $8 return to the national economy for every dollar invested in the World War II generation, and we think it's a no-brainer. It's the best use of your tax dollars, and we think even in times like this, when there's so much bad stuff going on, we think these young men and women can be a source of hope, they can be a source of leadership, and we think they're a key to the future. So if anyone ever asks you, why is the GI Bill so important, look around your neighborhood, talk to your family, and think about the World War II veterans and Vietnam veterans who helped build and create so many of our great institutions and establishments. And they're also teachers, they're community leaders, they're doing so much to give back. And that's why we're going to so ferociously defend it.
Now, you mentioned that Robert Wilkie was sworn in as the new Secretary of Veterans Affairs at the end of July. He's the fourth during the past 2 years while Donald Trump's been president. Do you think that he is doing a better job than his predecessors?
I'll start with the last question. No, he's not doing a better job. And I say fourth because we also had the Ronny Jackson debacle, which folks may seem like ancient history now. But so Bob McDonald was Obama's pick, and we recommended that he stay on. He was actually a Republican. He was asked to step down and replaced by David Shulkin, who was there for a little over a year and then was fired up over Twitter, basically. And then the president's personal doctor, Dr. Ronny Jackson, was nominated. His candidacy imploded. And then we eventually ended up with Secretary Wilkie. So that's been the last couple of years at the VA, right? Imagine any university or company going through that kind of changeover in an already difficult environment. This GI Bill problem is really the first one that's emerged on Wilkie's watch. He's extremely unavailable to the press. He probably won't come on your show, but he'll definitely be on Breitbart once a week. He's really, I think, clamped down on transparency. And he's not moving the culture in the right direction. He's opposed the Blue Water Navy expansion. He has not come out in support of the motto change. I don't think he's very visible. And that may be partially by design, but we need him out in front as an advocate for veterans, especially when there are bad situations like shootings or other traumatic events. We need him to be out in front educating the American public and advocating for veterans and explaining what PTSD is all about. If he's just in there to be a hatchet man for the president on a budget or to privatize things, then he's going to be the wrong choice for veterans. So this is really a critical time for him to define who he is, and veterans are going to be watching.
There's been concern expressed over the politicization of the military as when President Trump sent troops to keep peace and protect the border, in quotes, between the United States and Mexico from the so-called caravan of men, women, and children who are fleeing Central America. That happened just before the midterm elections. Is there any precedent for that sort of action?
Not in the modern military. I mean, I think it's important to note that the National Guard does this, yet he's deployed active duty troops down as a part of this maneuver. We're not a monolith as a community, Leonard. Our veterans are very, you know, diverse in terms of their background, their political views, but this is universally unpopular. You know, I think most folks feel like this is a distraction, that it was a political move. And I think on a very basic national security level, our troops have got a lot ready. You know, and you're literally taking folks out of the Middle East rotations and now sending them down to Mexico to lay down Constantino wire. So it doesn't seem like a smart use of our resources. And it's got a lot of pushback from within the Pentagon, I think across the veterans community. Our troops are going to do what they have to do, but they can't be used as a political toy. And I think that's where, in my view, Trump has been most unprecedented and at times most dangerous, is how he's politicized the troops. He kind of holds us up and says, hey, if you're opposing me, you're opposing the troops. He doesn't speak for us. No politician speaks for us. I don't even speak for everybody, right? We've all got our own voices. But if you look back to how he has manipulated our community around the attacks on the Khan family, John McCain, and maybe most of all, the national anthem. You know, our community is pretty divided on the national anthem issue, just like the rest of America. But to say that if you kneel when the national anthem comes, you're disrespecting the troops. Well, most troops don't think that. But this is an example of how our views are often manipulated and politicized, and by this administration in particular, in a way we've never seen before. Every president kind of plays with it. Obama did it. They all do it. But Trump's doing it at a level that we've never seen before.
And then there's the matter of three private citizens who are members of President Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort who are reported to have widespread influence within the VA. They are Marvel Entertainment Chairman Ike Perlmutter, West Palm Beach physician Bruce Moskowitz, and lawyer Mark Sherman. The VA is an agency that private citizens should have no official role in. What's going on there?
Yeah, this is kind of the height of the drama. Like, you know, when you're watching TV every day, you say, wow, you know, this administration is full of so much crazy stuff. You probably haven't even seen what's going on at the VA, and this is maybe the best example. The recent reporting and what we've seen over the last few years is that there are three guys at Mar-a-Lago, an associate at Mar-a-Lago, who are calling the shots. And they made life difficult for Secretary Shulkin when he's in there. He's been pretty vocal about how his hands were tied and how he had to go to them for approvals. And now it seems they're already, you know, pretty in close contact with Wilkie and trying to move him. And whether or not he can stand up to them is going to be key. But you've got, you know, three rich guys down in Mar-a-Lago, none of which I believe are veterans themselves, who seem to think they can fix the VA. This is kind of the dismissive kind of cavalier attitude that a lot of people have had around the VA. Oh, you know, it's so simple. They just need me over there. Well, I don't know what you know, running a comic book company does to qualify you to run one of the largest healthcare systems in the world, but that's the problem here. These guys are calling the shots. There's been no oversight. They haven't been vetted. And now it's come out. It's an issue of transparency. And just even if, let's say, hypothetically, you're not that bothered by the fact that three, you know, friends of the president in Mar-a-Lago are calling the shots at the VA. What if they were doing it for another agency? What if they were doing it for the Pentagon? What if they were deciding where we went to war? That's the real issue here that I think is even bigger than VA that we have to sound the alarm on. So we're hoping that this new Congress will exercise their subpoena power, that they will dig into this, they will find out what's going on, and they will give the American public and our veterans especially the answers they deserve.
We have very little time left, but I was wondering about the fact that President Trump has yet to visit the troops stationed in Afghanistan and Iraq, and he was missing on Veterans Day. What kind of signal does that send to the men and women who are serving in the military? Are those visits mostly for show or symbolic in nature, or do they actually mean more than that?
You know, I think they're both. You know, I think they're important. And again, not everybody's united on this, but it's kind of like, I said this in another interview, it's kind of like going to your kid's soccer game, right? You don't have to go, but as a parent, you probably should go. probably be there to show that you support, you know, the family, that you care, that you're watching, that it matters to you. So where you spend your time is a reflection of your priorities. And especially when we're sending folks to war, they need to know that their commander-in-chief remembers they're there. So let's say, hypothetically, it was just, you know, a PR stunt, and he went over there and zoomed in and zoomed out. At least for 24 hours, the news cycle would be focused on Afghanistan. And our community has started to call it Forgottistan. They feel like they're forgotten. They feel like our wars are forgotten. So I think that's really the opportunity here. And this is where it's a real head-scratcher. I mean, I think this is an unforced error for the president. This should be an easy one for him. And he's missing it. You know, and I think that just underscores how our community, even by the guy who says he loves us and supports us so much, he can't even go visit us. I think that underscores how we have fallen from the priority list for this country and why we need more accountability, and especially around the holidays. And, you know, there are going to be a lot of tables over the holidays, family tables that are missing someone because they're deployed or because they've been lost, whether it was to combat or suicide. And we hope folks can reflect on that and ensure that it's a top priority for the new Congress coming in.
And last month, 5 members of the military were killed in Afghanistan. And yet you say that Americans have pretty much forgotten that we have troops on the ground in both Afghanistan and Iraq. Do you know how many troops there are?
I think we've got about 15,000 in Afghanistan right now, and the numbers are kind of all over the place. But, you know, suffice to say, we've got, you know, tens of thousands of folks deployed around the world. And it's also, you know, we had an airstrike in Somalia last week. I mean, we've got folks in Syria. They're literally now all around the world in harm's way. And that's an important issue of accountability. I don't think most folks realize that we're doing airstrikes in Africa. Essentially, we are at war in countries that have not been authorized by the American people or by Congress. That there needs to be a real debate about the status of forces agreement and what it means to just have war happening without the American people knowing. But on a very human level, you know, we're losing men and women, and it hardly registers in the news. When I talked to you years ago, Leonard, I think there was controversy about the fact that certain news programs were showing the names of these folks. There was controversy around the coffins and whether or not we could take pictures of them. I mean, now those are happening. We have the pictures. But folks are tuned out. So, again, I think it behooves us to have a commander-in-chief who understands that responsibility and reminds people we're at war and also communicates the cost of war. I mean, that's America's sons and daughters. That's somebody's kids. And even if you don't agree with the war, I think you have an obligation to remind people that it's happening.
Paul Rykoff is the founder and executive director of the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. You can find more about them online at www.iava.org. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Leonard. Thank you so much. And you've been a real great service to the community in focusing on these issues over the years. We really do appreciate it.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. My great thanks to Paul Rykoff, to Todd McGovern, who prepared today's segment, to Reggie Johnson, who was at the audio controls, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, and to my producer, Jesse Lund, who helps make things run smoothly. Leonard Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.